Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you today's Wall Street Journal. Trump's investigation of Powell is also a warning to the next Fed chair. The investigation reflects the lengths to which the president will go to control the central bank, by Greg Ipp. The criminal investigation into Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell isn't ultimately about the Fed's headquarters or Powell or even interest rates. It's about power. President Trump intends to take control of the central bank no matter what the law or the courts say. In that sense, the investigation is also a message to whoever succeeds Powell, likely either Trump advisor Kevin Hassett or former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh. Both claim they will be independent. But if either sets interest rates contrary to Trump's desires, they can expect the same treatment as Powell. That's a powerful incentive to stay in line. Since returning to power a year ago, Trump has steadily obliterated the lines that once separated the president from other sources of federal authority. He fired Democratic members of agencies such as the Federal Trade Commission contrary to law, sacked career officials in justice, defense, and law enforcement deemed insufficiently loyal, and trampled on Congress's authority over spending and revenue. The Fed was an exception. Because politicians always want lower interest rates, which can lead to inflation, the Fed, by law and tradition, operates independently from the president and Congress. Presidents have pressured the Fed anyway, but usually behind closed doors while publicly claiming to respect its independence. Not Trump. He insists he should have some say over the interest rates, and many in his administration consider independence antithetical to the president's supreme authority over the executive branch. Though Trump appointed Powell in his first term, he grew disenchanted last year at Powell's refusal to cut interest rates more, often because of tariffs' contribution to inflation. The Supreme Court signaled it wouldn't allow Trump to fire Powell or any of the other six governors without cause. Undeterred, Trump has simply sought to engineer a cause. In August, he tried to fire Governor Lisa Cook for alleged mortgage application misrepresentations. Cook denied the allegations and has remained on the Fed while awaiting the Supreme Court to rule on the legality of Trump's actions. Trump made it clear his goal was to replace Cook with a loyalist in order to get control of the 7-member Board of Governors, who along with 5 of the 12 Reserve Bank presidents vote on interest rates. Once we have a majority, housing is going to swing and it's going to be great, he said at the time. This latest attack looks similar in design and intent. Trump wants not just lower rates, but control of the board, Mark Spindell, a Fed historian, said Sunday. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Trump want their hands on the institution to make more sweeping changes, such as how the Fed supervises banks or uses its balance sheet to intervene in markets, he said. Bill Pulte, director of Federal Housing Finance Agency and one of Trump's most partisan officials, kicked off the campaign attacking Powell for cost overruns. On renovations to the Fed's headquarters, the DOJ is scrutinizing Powell's testimony to Congress on the project. Powell said this is a pretext for his refusal to bend to Trump's wishes. Trump denied that to NBC News Sunday. Still, it is hard to explain the ferocity with which the administration has attacked Powell any other way. Federal projects, including Trump's, routinely go over budget without comparable recriminations. The price tag on Trump's White House ballroom has already doubled, up to $400 million from $200 million, albeit to be paid by private donors. He said before his first term that a border wall would cost $8 billion to $12 billion and Mexico would pay. Mexico didn't pay, and more than $60 billion has now been earmarked for the project. Legislators often complain that witnesses lie or mislead, yet that seldom results in prosecution, especially of the administration's own appointees. To secure conviction, prosecutors must prove a falsehood was made, knowingly and willfully, and to be materially false, fictitious, or fraudulent. Two former allies of Trump were accused of lying to Congress during his first term. Last year, Trump pressured the Justice Department to indict former Federal Bureau of Investigation Director James Comey, a Trump adversary, for lying to Congress. A federal judge dismissed the charges, ruling that the prosecutor Trump chose to bring the cases was unlawfully appointed. It is unclear whether Powell will ultimately be indicted, much less convicted. Powell's statement Sunday signaled he is refusing to be cowed, which means, for now, interest rate policy shouldn't change. The Trump officials are going after Powell without awaiting the Supreme Court's decision on Cook's removal reflects their determination to break the Fed's independence. They may succeed, even if they fail in court. The message to all Fed officials is defying Trump is an invitation to have their backgrounds and public statements investigated for a pretext for removal. Given that, who would wish to serve? Presumably only somebody ready to deliver what Trump wants. Technology. The Chinese company taking on the world's memory chip giants. As AI demand drives prices up, CXMT overcomes Washington's curbs to vie with Micron and South Korean leaders. By Yang Ji in Tokyo and Ji Young Sun in Seoul. China's national champion in memory chip manufacturing is preparing a $4 billion share offering after making sufficient technical advances, upending an industry dominated by South Korean and U.S. companies. The offering is by Changjin Memory Technologies, known as CXMT, is one of the biggest by a chip maker this century and would normally be great news for tech companies starved of memory chips during the artificial intelligence boom. AI data centers have been grabbing chip capacity that would otherwise serve the makers of computers, video game consoles, and smartphones, driving up prices for American consumers. But even though CXMT intends to boost production and says it wants more international business, the geopolitical walls are high. Successive U.S. administrations have tightened curbs on Chinese chip makers. And prosecutors in South Korea, home to memory chip leaders Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix, are alleging that some of CXMT's rise comes from theft of trade secrets obtained from former Samsung employees. Memory chips are like the fuel lines feeding the engines of computing machines. As AI engines made by NVIDIA of the U.S. and others get more powerful, they need more memory, both the traditional kind and an advanced type called high bandwidth memory. A single AI server now uses more dynamic random access memory than entire fleets of laptops, and the price of conventional DRAM is forecast to surge more than 50% this quarter compared with the previous quarter, according to research firm TrendForce. Until recently, the global DRAM market was dominated by three companies: Samsung, SK Hynix, and US-based Micron Technology. Those makers have pivoted toward higher-margin AI memory chips, and Micron is retreating from parts of the consumer market. That opens the door for CXMT. The company was formed a decade ago after a bid by a state-backed Chinese company to acquire Micron failed. A local government in the eastern city of Hefei decided it should create its own DRAM maker. The company, now led by U.S.-trained chip engineer Zhu Jiming, garnered support from a national tech fund and a who's who list of Chinese tech companies, including Alibaba and Xiaomi. CXMT said in late December that it had submitted plans to list on Shanghai's Nasdaq-like tech board, aiming to raise the equivalent of $4 billion. Recent capital injections have valued the company at more than $20 billion, analysts said. CXMT is among the stars in a roster of Chinese companies across the semiconductor industry that the government hopes will lift the country's self-sufficiency during its trade war with the U.S. From manufacturing specialist SMIC to equipment maker AMEC, Beijing is pushing the industry to develop local alternatives to everything the U.S. and its allies produce. CXMT's prospectus shows the company has rapidly advanced from prototype to mass production in just a few years. Revenue nearly tripled over 2 years to more than $3 billion in 2024. Analysts said its process technology has come within a generation or two of the industry leaders, and the company's global DRAM market share has risen to around 5% of revenue. The progress comes despite U.S. curbs on China's access to advanced chip-making equipment. The progress CXMT has made in the face of U.S. end-use controls on memory has surprised the industry, said Paul Trilio, technology policy lead at consulting firm DGA Albright Stonebridge Group. Triolo said U.S. concerns would be heightened if CXMT could supply high-bandwidth memory chips to Huawei, whose AI processors represent China's closest domestic alternative to NVIDIA's AI accelerators. According to DSET, a think tank backed by the Taiwanese government, CXMT built its foundation on the ruins of others, acquiring patents from the bankrupt German chipmaker Quemondo and raiding Taiwan's talent pool. In December, Korean prosecutors said they had indicted 10 people, including a former Samsung executive and employees, on charges of transferring secrets to CXMT, including technology to help CXMT mass-produce advanced DRAM chips. The suspects allegedly worked systemically to avoid detection, joining CXMT through shell companies, shifting offices, and disguising travel to China by routing trips through other locations. They exchanged a coded warning for using four heart emojis to warn each other in case South Korean tried to bar their travel or arrest them, prosecutors said. The prosecutors said the leak of trade secrets caused billions of dollars in losses to Samsung and South Korea's semiconductor-driven economy. Samsung and CXMT didn't respond to requests for comment. Prosecutors didn't disclose the names of the defendants. U.S. rules don't currently bar American companies from doing business with CXMT, but U.S. lawmakers already have signaled their discomfort. In 2022, Apple abandoned plans to use NAND flash storage memory chips from China's Yangtze Memory Technologies after congressional opposition. A year later, several members of Congress urged the Commerce Department to consider adding CXMT to the department's export control blacklist, citing concerns over intellectual property theft and the firm's role in China's industrial strategy. Gregory Allen, a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, said CXMT's pursuit of high-bandwidth memory for AI computing was particularly concerning. U.S. export controls have blocked Huawei from acquiring HBM chips in recent years, and having a company like CXMT fill the gap would be extremely valuable to Beijing, he said. The rise of CXMT translates to the rise of domestic Chinese AI chip making, Allen said. Xu, the company chief executive, studied at China's elite Tsinghua University and in New York at what is now called Stony Brook University. He worked in Silicon Valley and previously founded a Chinese maker of specialized memory chips. Xu told Tsinghua's magazine more than a decade ago, whoever leads in memory technology will be able to dominate the entire integrated circuit industry. Middle East, U.S. steps up planning for possible action in Iran. Trump aides are set to brief the president Tuesday on measures including military, cyber, and economic to follow through on his threats, by Alexander Ward and Laura Sigelman. President Trump is scheduled to be briefed Tuesday on options to respond to the protests in Iran, according to U.S. officials, a sign the president is considering reprimanding the regime for its crackdown on demonstrators Ozzie has repeatedly threatened. The president's planned meeting with senior administration officials will be a discussion about the next steps, which could include boosting anti-government sources online, deploying secretive cyber weapons against Iranian military and civilian sites, placing more sanctions on the regime, and military strikes, the officials said. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and Joint Chiefs Chair General Dan Kane are expected to attend the Tuesday meeting, the officials said. Trump, speaking Sunday to reporters on Air Force One, said he had been reviewing military options to strike Iran after the regime was starting to cross his red line of not killing protesters. "We are looking at some very strong options," he said. "If Iran retaliates to an American attack by targeting U.S. troops in the region, we will hit them at levels that they've never been hit before." He also said that the leaders of Iran called to negotiate. "We may have to act before a meeting. A meeting is being set up," Iran called. "They want to negotiate." Trump isn't expected to make a final decision at the meeting as the deliberations are at an early stage. On Sunday, Iran's parliamentary speaker threatened to attack American military bases in the Middle East if the U.S. acted first. During preliminary discussions between senior administration staff last week, aides expressed concern that the U.S. or Israel, acting in the name of protesters, could fuel regime propaganda that hostile outside powers are behind the countrywide uprising, some of the officials said. The Pentagon hasn't moved any forces in preparation for potential military strikes. The U.S. would need to put assets in place not only to launch attacks, but also protect American forces in the region. The U.S. recently moved the aircraft carrier USS General R. Ford and its strike group from the Mediterranean to Latin America, leaving no carrier in either the Middle East or Europe. The discussions come at a time of already heightened tensions in the region, especially over Syria. The U.S. launched wide-scale strikes against Islamic State targets in Syria on Saturday in response to the killings of two American soldiers and a civilian interpreter last month. Memos are being sent to agencies seeking their input on specific responses to the Iran situation, including potential military targets and economic options, ahead of the Trump meeting, according to some of the officials. One option under discussion is the possibility of the U.S. sending terminals of Starlink, a satellite-based internet service owned by Elon Musk, into Iran for the first time during the Trump administration, officials said, which could help protesters skirt a recent internet shutdown in the country. Trump said he would speak with Musk about sending Starlink satellite internet terminals into Iran. Rubio and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke Saturday about the protests and other Middle East matters in Syria and Gaza, officials said. Some administration officials are concerned that any U.S. response could escalate tensions in the region, potentially provoking a direct confrontation between the U.S., Iran, and possibly Israel. The administration is also aware that acting in a more symbolic way that harms but doesn't degrade the regime could demoralize protesters who believe Washington will support them. The White House didn't respond to a request for comment. Jacob Hellberg, State Department Undersecretary for Economic Affairs, wrote Sunday on social media that President Trump's strategy of maximum pressure has brought the regime to its knees. Tuesday's meeting would be the first time Trump sits down with senior officials for a formal discussion of his options. However, Trump frequently asks aides for their thoughts on serious topics, including Iran policy, outside of less formal briefings, and has already received some ideas from his staff about what his response should be. The president has escalated his forceful language since the Iranian protests began 2 weeks ago. On January 2nd, he said on social media that the U.S. is locked and loaded as he warned the Iranian regime not to kill peaceful protesters. Then on Friday, he said the U.S. would start shooting if authorities opened fire on demonstrators. He has continued offering his support for the uprising. Iran is looking for freedom, perhaps like never before, he posted Saturday to social media. The USA stands ready to help. He also linked a story about a man in London who removed Iran's flag from its embassy and replaced it with an anti-regime banner. The State Department, alluding to the U.S. operation to remove Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro after many Trump warnings, posted on X, "Do not play games with President Trump. When he says he'll do something, he means it." Trump has been emboldened after the Maduro mission, as well as the bombing campaigns in Nigeria, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, he believes have secured U.S. interests, officials say. Vice President J.D. Vance last week said Iran could still show a willingness to negotiate with the U.S. over its nuclear program, a potential sign that Washington is open to a diplomatic result to the current crisis, not a military one. The smartest thing for them to have done, it was true 2 months ago, it is true today, is for them to actually have a real negotiation with the United States about what we need to see when it comes to their nuclear program, he told reporters in a White House briefing. Tehran has made no serious entreaties about talks in recent months, U.S. officials say. Tehran for now shows no signs of fearing U.S. action. Beyond the threat to American bases, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and his aides indicate a broader crackdown on the demonstrators is coming. Mohammad Mobahedi Azad, is Iran's attorney general, said Saturday people who take part in the protests are an enemy of God, a charge that results in the death penalty. The country's army said Saturday it would firmly safeguard national interests, strategic infrastructure, and public property, blaming Israel and what it called terrorist groups for the unrest and vowing to thwart the enemy's plots. The protests began with merchants protesting economic conditions 2 weeks ago, growing into a nationwide revolt on January 8th against the regime. More than 500 people, including members of security services, have been killed in the unrest, human rights activists in Iran said Sunday. A new aerial strike on Iran would be the second time Trump has authorized an attack on the country. In August, B-2 stealth bombers heavily damaged three of the Iranian nuclear sites, setting back the regime's nuclear program. Policy: Trump inclined to keep Exxon out of Venezuela. President said he didn't like comments from company CEO during a meeting Friday at the White House. By Annie Linsky. President Trump said he might block ExxonMobil from drilling in Venezuela after the company's top executive publicly acknowledged the barriers involved in doing business in the country. "I'll probably be inclined to keep Exxon out," Trump said Sunday evening, speaking to reporters traveling with him aboard Air Force One. During a meeting with oil company executives at the White House on Friday, Exxon chief executive Darren Woods said that Venezuela is currently uninvestable without significant changes to the country's commercial frameworks, legal systems, and hydrocarbon laws. He expressed confidence those changes could be put in place with the Trump administration and Venezuelan government working together. "I didn't like their response. They're playing too cute," Trump said Sunday of Wood's comments, adding that the other companies want to invest in Venezuela. Exxon didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Trump has been pushing U.S. energy companies to invest in Venezuela following the capture of the country's leader, Nicolas Maduro, but some companies have expressed concerns about entering the volatile country. At the White House on Friday, Trump told the oil industry executives that the U.S. would provide unspecified security guarantees to companies that go into Venezuela and invest in the country's ailing energy infrastructure. Exxon has troubled history in Venezuela. Its assets were nationalized for the second time in 2007. The company sued for $12 billion but recovered only a fraction of that sum. Wood said Exxon would need to see some pretty significant changes from what it has seen there historically to consider entering the country a third time. He said he could have a technical team visit to assess the current state of Venezuelan assets within the next couple of weeks. The company has a major oil project in neighboring Guyana. ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance expressed similar reservations about re-entering the country during Friday's meeting. He told Trump his company is currently the largest non-sovereign credit holder in Venezuela and is owned $12 billion. ConocoPhillips also left the country in 2007. Trump dismissed the possibility of covering any of those debts. "We're not going to look at what people lost in the past," he said Friday. "You're going to make a lot of money, but we're not going to go back." Chevron is the only major U.S. company currently active in Venezuela. Vice Chairman Mark Nelson said at Friday's meeting that the company can ramp up production relatively quickly, but even he stopped short of committing to a big investment during the public part of the meeting. On Sunday, Trump posted an image on Truth Social that referred to himself as the acting president of Venezuela. After the raid, Trump said Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado doesn't have the support or the respect within the country to lead the country. He instead threw his support behind Delcy Rodriguez, a Maduro lieutenant who is serving as acting president of the country. Trump is expected to meet with Machado at the White House this week. The president told reporters on Sunday that he plans to meet with Rodriguez at some point, adding, "She's been very good." Artificial intelligence. Job seekers find a new source of income, training AI to do their old roles. Buzzy AI startup Mercor employees, tens of thousands of white-collar contractors and gigs open to anyone with expertise in their own field. By Katherine Bindley. One of the Bay Area's hottest startups is hiring like crazy. The catch: you have to be willing to train artificial intelligence to one day do your job as well as you can. Welcome to the next gig economy. Instead of driving for Uber or delivering Postmates, a new wave of workers is signing up to school AI. These white-collar contractors review and critique the output of the large language models that power chatbots and other AI tools. Not just anyone can work for Mercor, an AI startup valued at $10 billion. Applicants have to demonstrate their abilities in the interview process, and you might work on the same project for weeks or even months. The vast list of subject area experts Mercor seeks includes astronomers, psychologists, industrial engineers, filmmakers, creative writers, comedians, legal experts, investment bankers, and venture capitalists. A dermatologist can make as much as $250 an hour helping a healthcare partner develop its decision support tools. Poets who enhance AI's understanding of poetic structure, literary nuance, and emotional expression can earn as much as $150 an hour. Mercor hired over 30,000 contractors in 2025 to work on projects for some of the largest AI companies. Clients have included OpenAI and Anthropic. Economic uncertainty, tariffs, and wait-and-see approach regarding the extent to which AI can handle tasks have all contributed to a growing unemployment rate, which in November hit its highest level in 4 years. White-collar workers are finding themselves applying to hundreds of jobs. For many, that now includes gigs with Mercor. People can earn a $250 referral bonus by getting others to sign on with Mercor, contributing to a flood of job postings on LinkedIn and speculation that the whole thing must be a scam. It's not. But training AI to take over human tasks could be considered a dark irony in today's anemic job market. When Katie Williams, 30, first saw a job listed for Mercor, the posting said the company was looking for a video editor. Williams, who lives in Houston, went to school for video editing and has worked in news and social media marketing. She applied and soon landed in an interview conducted by an unseen AI proctor with a male-sounding voice. She wasn't quite sure what the job would entail, but the pay was as much as $45 an hour, so she moved ahead. Williams is now about 6 months into various projects that have involved watching video clips and writing out captions of everything that's happening in them, and rating the quality of videos generated by prompts. You are listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. She has mixed feelings about the work. I joked with my friends, I'm training AI to take my job someday. Coworkers in her Slack channel express similar sentiments, she adds. They don't feel great about training AI, but they feel their job prospects are limited. Many of the people we work with already see AI as inevitable in their field, but that doesn't mean humans will run out of meaningful work, a Mercor spokeswoman said in a written statement. Many of our experts see it as their responsibility to infuse their knowledge and expertise into the models to ensure accurate and thoughtful outcomes. Applicants undergo an initial video interview conducted by AI, and the company says a small percentage are required to share their screen to show their work. Once hired, workers must install time tracking software. The software ensures contractors are working during billable hours and aren't cutting corners by using AI to critique the AI, which some have been caught doing, according to the Mercor spokeswoman. After more than 20 years at the same job as an automotive journalist, Peter Valdez De Pino was laid off in 2024. He spent months sending out resumes for full-time jobs to no avail. He finds freelance work inconsistent, and it doesn't make up for his past salary. Though he's saved for his retirement, he'd rather not start dipping in yet. One day, Mercor popped up in his LinkedIn feed. The 61-year-old now spends 20 to 30 hours a week critiquing AI's attempts at writing news articles. He finds the work challenging and says it's had the pleasant side effect of improving his own writing. The nature of the work does produce some internal conflict. Valdez De Pina says journalists will always exist. He thinks people appreciate ideas and writing from humans, but he worries that AI could lead to more job losses. I didn't invent AI, and I'm not going to uninvent it, he says. If I were to stop doing this, would that stop it? The answer is no. Laura Cattell, an academic currently seeking nonprofit and government jobs, learned about Mercor from a friend. She applied and soon got an offer. The next step was to sign a contract, which was reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. She interpreted it to mean that she was granting royalty-free rights to her existing and future academic papers and any other intellectual property that might benefit an unspecified Mercor client. I thought that's a bit of an overreach, she said. Cattell tried to amend the contract. Melvin, a Mercor AI assistant, replied via email, saying the contract couldn't be amended. If she didn't like it, she could walk. It's very much feeling of having a lot of your dignity taken away from you, she says. Mercor says the contract only applies to a worker's writing, code, or other intellectual property if the worker chooses to use it in the course of their project. Anything the worker has created on their own and doesn't use is exempt from the terms of the agreement. Sarah Kubik, an attorney with her own solo practice, generates supplemental income during slow months by doing contract AI training work for Mercor. She has also worked for two other AI training companies. She says one project she worked on for Mercor was on behalf of OpenAI. Kubik says most people who approach her about Mercor are looking to get some work themselves, but make some negative comments. They've alleged to her that Mercor is a scam or said she's training AI to take jobs. Kubik balks at the idea and that AI will replace lawyers, though she says some legal assistants might not be so lucky. She finds training AI rewarding and looks forward to AI one day handling some parts of the job, such as screening new clients. Her contracting work has convinced her that there's a lot of hype and grandiose statements about AI's potential. It's taught me the limitations of AI. Airlines. Allegiant Travel to buy Sun Country Airlines for about $1.1 billion. Smaller carriers have sought tie-ups to address pressure on their business models in recent years. By Allison Sider and Dean Seal. Allegiant Travel reached a roughly $1.1 billion deal to buy Sun Country Airlines as budget-focused U.S. airlines struggle with stiff competition from larger rivals. The proposed cash and stock deal would bring together two carriers that have primarily served price-sensitive U.S. vacation seekers at the same time that the industry has come under strain. Large carriers such as United Airlines and Delta Air Lines have deployed their own bare-bones fares to lure bargain hunters while catering to faster-growing demand from well-heeled travelers willing to pay for extras. Allegiant and Sun Country have been able to steer clear of some of the difficulties that have plagued the low-cost end of the airline industry by being more selective about where and when they fly. We think this combination sets us up to be the clear leader of our sector in the industry, Allegiant Chief Executive Gregory Anderson said in an interview. He said the merger brings together two profitable airlines that would together be able to serve more vacation destinations in the U.S. and abroad. Minneapolis-based Sun Country has been bolstered by its charter business and cargo shipping demand in its work flying for Amazon.com, and Allegiant has been adept at avoiding head-to-head competition with larger competitors by steering clear of crowded routes. The deal is also the latest effort by smaller carriers to bulk up as they look to challenge the big airlines that they say dominate the industry. Alaska Air acquired Hawaiian Airlines in 2024, an effort by Frontier Airlines parent and Spirit Airlines to merge in 2022, was stymied by a competing bid from JetBlue Airways and was later blocked by antitrust regulators. Spirit filed for bankruptcy for the second time last year. Anderson said Allegiant and Sun Country's routes have minimal overlap, and the two carriers are both small. We believe the deal is pro-consumer, it's pro-competition, he said. Allegiant said its deal values Sun Country at $18.89 a share, a roughly 20% premium of Sun Country's closing price Friday. Shareholders in Allegiant will own about two-thirds of the combined company if the deal is finalized, with Sun Country shareholders owning the remaining third. Allegiant will also absorb $400 million of Sun Country's debt, the company said. The companies expect the merger to close in the second half of this year, subject to regulatory approval. Allegiant's parent company has been restructuring its business to focus exclusively on airline operations. It sold its Sunseeker Resort and Aileron Golf Course in Florida to Blackstone Real Estate Funds for $20 million last September. The sale of the loss-making resort was seen as a boon for Allegiant's stock, according to Deutsche Bank analyst Mike Linenberg. Management are now 100% focused on running the airline, and various opportunities are likely to surface in the domestic market, Linenberg said in a research note last month. Remembering Bob Weir, a pioneering member of the Grateful Dead. The rhythm guitarist and singer brought sophisticated playing, a breezy voice, and a grand sonic vision to the band, whose legacy he celebrated in various groups for decades after its dissolution, by Mark Myers. The word short wasn't in Bob Weir's vocabulary. A founding member and co-leader of the Grateful Dead and the band's rhythm guitarist who sang lead on many of its songs, Mr. Weir died on Saturday at age 78, as one of the Dead's frontmen from 1965 to the band's dissolution in 1995. He helped pioneer the group's long-form jamming approach to concert songs that could last upward of 40 minutes. He also was a sonic architect, insisting that studio albums by the Dead sounded sterling and pushing for more distinctive live audio. The result was the Wall of Sound, a massive bank of carefully chosen stage speakers that projected clear fidelity without distortion. Following co-founder Jerry Garcia's death in 1995, Mr. Weir extended the band's legacy by performing several groups that included former Dead members, including Rat Dog, The Other Ones, Further, and most notably Dead & Company. In 2025, the band performed a two-month residency at the Sphere in Las Vegas. Though Mr. Weir never won a competitive Grammy, he received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 2007 as a member of the Grateful Dead. Early on, few artists worked harder or longer than Mr. Weir and the Grateful Dead to establish and define the rock concert ethos while advancing hippie culture. The band toured extensively and exhaustively and rarely declined an invitation in the late 1960s and early 70s to play at small and large outdoor festivals, when many of them were proudly free. The Dead's long list of landmark festivals included the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, Woodstock in 1969, and the Summer Jam at Watkins Glen in 1973. Mr. Weir's approach on rhythm guitar featured intricate chord voicings, sophisticated interplay with Garcia, and modal progressions inspired by 1960s jazz pianists, including McCoy Tyner. Mr. Weir's influence was immediate on artists and jam bands of the 1970s and beyond, including the Allman Brothers Band, Fish, Dave Matthews Band, and Wilco. Mr. Weir and the Dead largely avoided hard rock and retained their identity and popularity by blending blues, folks, roots, and country with rock to create a smooth but erudite sound. As a songwriter, Mr. Weir wrote or co-wrote many of the Dead's best-known compositions, including Truckin', Playin' in the Band, Sugar Magnolia, Estimated Profit, and The Music Never Stopped, songs geared for FM radio and live performances. Mr. Weir's lead vocals had the bucolic appeal of freshly cut hay. Breezy and soothing with a light twang, his singing style allowed for space, letting him take on the role of a storyteller. His voice could calm and unite massive audiences and shrink the size of expansive venues to that of an intimate coffee house. Offstage, Mr. Weir was personable and warm, but highly analytic. During a 2017 interview with the Journal, he talked about the Dead's passion for vocal harmony. Under the name The Warlocks in 1967, the band recorded a single behind jazz vocalist singer John Hendricks. We listened to Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross albums to familiarize ourselves with John's vocal style, Mr. Weir said. Working with a man with that kind of sound, it stuck with us. Born in San Francisco in 1947, Mr. Weir tried but failed to master the piano and trumpet before taking up the guitar at age 13. Educational challenges due to dyslexia, a condition little understood at the time, resulted in expulsion from multiple schools. At age 16, he met Garcia, 21, in Palo Alto, California, and they formed a jug band, shifting to electric instruments following the rapid popularity of the Beatles in the U.S. As the Grateful Dead in 1965, their first performances were at Ken Kesey's Acid Test, a series of informal LSD parties held by author Ken Kesey in the Bay Area, when the psychedelic drug was still legal. The 12 or so events would continue into 1966. While acid and psilocybin mushrooms became popular in San Francisco, Mr. Weir and the band took tripping on the road, influencing both Deadheads, superfans who followed the group from concert to concert, and the youth culture nationwide. Though LSD was part of the band's mystique and popularity, Mr. Weir said his experience with it just lasted over a year. "I felt it wasn't bringing me much in the way of clarity or new direction," he told Britain's Guardian newspaper in 2025. But the physical strain of long tours and extended sets took a toll. Mr. Weir told the Journal that the band took different pills to stay awake and then to combat insomnia, which led to a drug bust and the song Truckin'. But in concert, Robert Hunter's lyrics, such as "Most of the cats that you meet on the street speak of true love," proved to be a mouthful for Mr. Weir. "I complained bitterly about how those dense verses were going to go. Jerry's response was, 'Sing 'em like Chuck Berry in school days.'" Jerryman, I should use Chuck's rapid-fire delivery and enunciation to fit a lot of words into each measure. It worked, and Mr. Weir added yet another artist to his long list of influences. Asked by CBS Sunday Morning's John Blackstone in 2022 whether composing was still daunting at his age, Mr. Weir shrugged, "The blank page is the greatest challenge life has to offer." Wall Street is making bullish bets on the economy. Signs of economic optimism include rallying retail stocks and stubbornly high bond yields, by Sam Goldfarb. Call it the glass half full market. In recent weeks, government data have been mixed, showing both disappointing job gains and robust economic growth. But U.S. investors have been focusing on the positive side of things, piling into bets that suggest that they have strong confidence that the economy will keep powering forward. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is off to its best start to a year since 2003. Investor demand has been particularly strong for the stocks of companies exposed to swings in the economy, such as retailers. Despite expectations for some further interest rate cuts, yields on longer-term U.S. Treasuries remain stubbornly high, a sign investors don't expect a recession that would trigger deeper cuts. Investors generally explain their optimism in two ways. First, they think recent economic data has been reasonably encouraging, with the slowdown in job growth largely caused by decreased immigration and government layoffs rather than a sharp downturn in private sector labor demand. Second, they are hopeful that the economy can improve from here, thanks in part to reduced trade policy uncertainties and the lagged impact of last year's tax cuts. "We're looking at resilient real and nominal growth in the U.S., said Blarina Urisi, chief U.S. economist at T. Rowe Price. "So the stock market will do well in that environment historically." Wall Street's rosy outlook was on full display Friday. New data showed that the economy added a seasonally adjusted 50,000 jobs in December, below economists' expectations for a 73,000 increase. Job gains for the previous 2 months were also revised lower by a combined 76,000. Still, stocks rallied, with the Dow pushing closer to the 50,000 milestone. A big reason was some brighter aspects of the report, including a drop in the unemployment rate, which some see as the best gauge of labor market strength. In an encouraging sign for investors, recent stock market gains have been broad-based, not just powered by the tech sector, as has been the case over much of the past few years. Information technology, in fact, has been the second worst performing sector in the S&P 500 this month, outperforming only utilities. The top four performing sectors have been materials, consumer discretionary, industrials, and energies, all seen as particularly sensitive to the growth outlook. One tailwind for stocks has been expectations for more interest rate cuts this year. Cyclical stocks started outperforming last month after Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell signaled openness to more cuts if there are further signs of weakness in the labor market. Investors are also much more optimistic about the outlook from Washington, D.C. this year, with the November midterm elections putting pressure on President Trump to pursue more growth-friendly policies following last year's trade wars. In recent weeks, the administration has been pushing an affordability agenda, scaling back some tariffs while introducing policies intended to push down mortgage rates. Trump has also floated the idea of using revenue from tariffs to fund rebates to taxpayers, an idea that some investors believe could eventually gain traction despite an initial cool reception from congressional Republicans. At the same time, a potential Supreme Court ruling against some of Trump's tariffs would also be largely welcomed on Wall Street. Optimism about the economy isn't only reflected in stocks. Bonds have sent similar signals, with the gap widening between the yields on short and long-term treasury yields, or what is known on Wall Street as a steepening yield curve. Since the end of July, Bets on rate cuts have caused the yield on the 2-year note to fall more than 0.4 percentage points to just over 3.5%. The yield on the 10-year note has declined less than 0.2 percentage points to a little under 4.2%. Investors say there are several possible explanations for the widening gap, including some negative ones. Those include increased worries on Wall Street about whether the Fed can retain its independence amid pressure from Trump to sharply cut rates. Mostly, though, investors see the steepening curve as a positive sign. Yields on treasuries largely reflect expectations for what rates set by the Fed will average over the life of a bond. When the Fed is cutting rates, that tends to drag down short-term yields. But longer-term yields can lag behind as long as economic growth is solid and investors see a risk that rates could move higher again in the future. U.S. growth continues to be in a very good place, said Olumi Olalabi, head of the U.S. rates team at Neuberger Berman. It's going to be difficult for longer-term yields to trade so low when the economy is growing at the pace at which it's growing. Some investors argue that markets might reflect a little too much confidence. Bryan Jacobson, chief economist strategist at Annex Wealth Management, said that corporate profits could be hurt if businesses start over-investing because of new tax incentives or a fear of losing out to competitors in the artificial intelligence build-out. I think that the economic outlook is a positive one, but my big concern is that it's already priced in. Washington's new lobbyists paid online influencers with few rules. Corporate and foreign interests pour money into getting pro-Trump social media stars to push their causes. By Maggie Severns, Natalie Andrews, Josh Dazy, and Eliza Collins. Last summer, Donald Trump's 28-year-old former campaign aide, Alex Brusewitz, had some advice for the president: reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. Nearly 70% of Republican voters support Trump on this. No brainer, he said, to more than 640,000 followers on X. What Brusewitz left out of the post: a political action committee funded by legal marijuana's biggest players had just paid him $300,000. Trump's return to the White House has transformed the federal government and upended the business of lobbying, creating a new class of Washington operatives that blur the lines between consulting, advocacy, and journalism. Corporate and foreign interests that used to rely primarily on paid lobbyists to pitch their case to lawmakers and administration officials are instead pouring money into trying to get their cause promoted by a group of young conservative influencers known to be close to Trump's staff. A camera-ready pack of Gen Z social media natives, many of whom were too young to vote when Trump announced his first run for office, are reaping the rewards. They don't work for traditional news outlets and are thus unshackled from newsroom ethics rules, such as the typical ban on accepting gifts worth more than $25. They don't have to follow the disclosure laws that apply to big money super PACs or lobbyists, and they have large followings eager to hear pro-Trump views, a goldmine for those looking to sway both Washington and the public. Israel made plans over the past year to spend $900,000 on an influencer campaign with a U.S. audience, according to disclosure documents, as Israel fights negative sentiment on the right. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with conservative social media stars on at least two of his visits. The solar energy and health industries have paid thousands of dollars to influencers to support their interests, according to people who have been offered or participated in such deals. Qatar Business Interests and others have courted those with online political followings. MAGA influencers are turning access to the White House into lucrative new businesses. Trump's former campaign manager, Brad Parscale, has pivoted from campaigning to running a prominent firm that specializes in connecting influencers to companies and others willing to pay for their posts. Bershowitz's comments had focused attention on the marijuana reclassification issue. In August, boxer Mike Tyson reposted Bershowitz's comments that said reclassification would be well received. In October, Bershowitz, who had no role in the administration and works for an outside political group, aligned with the president, told the Free Press that it would be a politically savvy move. In December, Trump overrode objections from Republican lawmakers and directed the federal government to reclassify the drug. A White House spokesperson said, "It's essentially that we meet Americans where they are and allow media from across the ideological spectrum to cover the White House, and that the administration is adapting to the new media landscape in 2025. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said Trump heard from many different people about reclassifying marijuana and decided doing it was the best policy and political decision to make for the country. Party by the pool. One of the largest historic spenders on Washington lobbying, Qatar, is pursuing an influencer strategy that appears to be paying dividends. In November, it sponsored trips to Doha for several pro-Trump social media personalities, promising interactions with members of Congress who were also there, and celebrities, and VIP Formula One tickets with paddock access and that regularly go for more than $10,000 apiece. Thanksgiving looking a little different this year, former journalist Caitlin Sinclair wrote on Instagram alongside a photo of a glimmering hotel pool at night and the outside of a Qatari outpost of Cipriani, the classic New York Italian spot, where partygoers inside ate oysters while a woman in a sequin dress sang Stand By Me. Those who went to Doha said they weren't paid to post specific messages about the trip, but some offered glowing reviews. Rob Smith, a veteran and gay pro-Trump commentator, Instagrammed a photo of himself beaming next to Serena Williams. TBH, I had zero clue that Doha was such a cultural hub, he wrote in the caption. In another post after the trip, Smith, who has close to 500,000 followers on X, said his visit had been eye-opening and that he wanted to help keep America strong by understanding and highlighting the unique and mutually beneficial military and financial partnerships that we share with Qatar. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.